From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 21st of April, 2009. Congress comes back from spring break to tackle health care. We'll hear why some advocates say they're being left out. New Orleans residents get their day in court and charge the government's negligence is partly to blame for post-Hurricane Katrina destruction. And ever wonder where your dead cell phone winds up? Chances are it might be threatening human health in the developing world. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. President Obama said today that torture memos released last week reveal a loss of moral bearings. He defended his decision to not seek prosecution for CIA officers who conducted enhanced interrogations within the guidelines they were given. However, he suggested that he is open to a different position for those who crafted those guidelines.
With respect to those who formulated those legal decisions, I would say that that is going to be more of a decision for the Attorney General within the parameters of various laws, and I don't want to prejudge that. I think that we should be looking forward and not backwards. I think for Congress to examine ways that it can be done in a bipartisan fashion, outside of the typical hearing process that can sometimes break down and break it entirely along party lines, to the extent that there are independent participants who are above reproach and have credibility, that would probably be a more sensible approach to take.
Obama called for a further accounting of events and added that he remains concerned about investigations interfering with national security operations. The British Secret Service, MI5, today admitted it gave false evidence during a Guantanamo detainee case and apologized to the High Court. Tomorrow, the High Court will hear fresh demands for the disclosure of documents that show exactly who in the British government was complicit in his interrogation and torture. From London, Naomi Fowler.
The British government has always denied claims that it approved the kidnap, often referred to as rendition, and torture of British resident Binyam Mohamed, released earlier this year from Guantanamo Bay. A letter from a government lawyer apologises on behalf of an MI5 officer, referred to as Witness A, who gave what it calls incorrect evidence to the High Court about when the CIA kept British intelligence informed about Mohamed's secret interrogation. The letter also apologises for not handing over 13 documents which it acknowledges should have been passed to the judges. Judges have already said some secret documents appear to show British intelligence officials were present when Mohamed was allegedly tortured. Lawyers believe the documents also show who it was in government that implicitly approved the treatment. The Foreign Secretary argues that their release would damage US-UK relations. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
A veteran and two soldiers' mothers asked a federal judge in New Jersey today to rule the Iraq War unconstitutional. Citing a very strict constitutional interpretation by the Supreme Court in an unrelated case, they asked the court to apply equal stringency to its interpretation of the president's constitutional authority to invade another country without Congress first officially declaring war. The government countered that the court does not have the appropriate purview to decide on a political matter. After a deadline for surrender passed today, fighting continued between Sri Lankan Tamil Tiger rebels and government forces. Free Speech Radio News' Panaya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
Rebels have accused the government of killing about 1,000 civilians. The government denied the claim and blamed the rebels of targeting civilians. Yesterday, the government declared a 24-hour deadline by which the Tigers were to surrender or face a final assault. The deadline expired at noon today with no word from the Tamil Tigers. The military says it will continue its offensive to rescue the civilians held by the rebels. They claim in the past 2 days alone, nearly 50,000 civilians fled the area following a military push into the government-designated safe zone. The International Red Cross says the situation is catastrophic and the fighting has killed and wounded hundreds of civilians who have only minimal access to medical care. Humanitarian agencies are concerned for the safety of some 150,000 to 200,000 civilians trapped in the conflict, while international countries are pressing the parties for a permanent ceasefire. Ponneya Manikavasagam, FSRN, in Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
The Environmental Protection Agency announced today that it's rolling back a 2006 Bush administration policy that eased reporting requirements regarding toxic chemicals. The EPA has restored rules requiring companies to fully disclose the toxic chemicals they release into the environment. And in other news from Washington, the Pentagon is reclaiming work it had outsourced to Lockheed Martin. Tanya Snyder has more.
Defense Department officials will handle veterans' pay and benefits themselves from now on. The task was handed over to defense contractor Lockheed Martin in 2002. Democratic Representative Dennis Kucinich has accused the company of poor performance, delays of up to 5.5 years, and exorbitant charges. The allegations came as part of Kucinich's investigation into Bush-era privatization efforts. Lockheed processed veterans' pay and benefits totaling more than $3.5 billion a month, and they say they did their job accurately and on time. The switch is largely the result of a law passed last year directing the Defense Department to consider hiring civilians rather than outsourcing. The department says that taking the payroll task back from the private corporation will save up to $25 million over the next 10 years. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
For Free Speech Radio news from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Participants at the Global Conference Against Racism scrambled to respond to a massive walkout after Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called Israel's policies racist. FSRN's Sacagawea Hall reports.
The Durban Review Conference has been plagued with division even before it started. The division was intensified Monday when the proceedings were interrupted with a protest inside of the General Assembly. Outburst ignited when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, President of Iran, began to make comments about Israel. The direct action was planned by the World Jewish Congress. 23 countries, mostly from Europe, walked out. Tuesday, Amos Wako, the Attorney General of Kenya and President of the Assembly, announced that the outcome document had been approved.
What we have decided shows the outcome when you remain engaged in the process. It shows that boycotts do not assist. It shows that one can remain constructively engaged and reach a consensus.
Although the president mentioned the boycott in his speech, Navi Pillay, High Commissioner for Human Rights, denied the boycott, Ahmadinejad's comments, or the walkout had any impact on the early announcement. The adoption was scheduled for Friday. Pillay says it is a success that the document has been adopted by consensus earlier in the week.
The fact that this document has been adopted by all but 9 states, I think, is our answer, what I call success.
She went on to say the process was by consensus and there was no reason to hold up the adoption. Some observers told FSRN the decision to announce the approval was made early to avoid conflict. The document reaffirms the 2001 Durban Declaration and Program of Action and calls on states to implement all commitments made to prevent, combat, and eradicate racism. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Geneva.
A bank takes out a loan and then wants to pay it back. It sounds like a simple equation, but not if you're a bank that receives TARP bailout funds from the government. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner appeared before the Congressional Oversight Panel today to address this issue and others relating to how TARP funds are being distributed, paid back, and what future plans entail. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, Elizabeth Warren, told Treasury Secretary Geithner that Americans are frustrated and need answers.
People are angry because they're paying for programs that haven't been fully explained and have no apparent benefit for their families or for the economy as a whole, but that seem to leave enough cash in the system for lavish bonuses or golf outings. None of this seems fair. People need to understand why you're making the choices that you're making. People want to see action described in terms that make sense to them.
Lawmakers also wanted to know about financial institutions who wanted to give TARP funds back. The Treasury says it's not just the health of the bank that will be the deciding factor. Representative Jeb Haserling from Texas pressed Geithner on the issue.
If there are firms that wish to repay taxpayer their money, why wouldn't you take the money back?
My basic obligation and our responsibility is to make sure that the system as a whole, has the ability to provide the credit that recovery requires. And so we need to make a careful judgment about what policies are going to best promote that objective. Under the laws, the conditions established in the Recovery Act, the judgment about when institutions can repay is a judgment that the federal banking agencies have to make. And they're in the process of looking now at what set of standards and principles should guide repayment.
Some analysts say Treasury's response is to give the government more oversight and control. David Min is Director for Financial Market Policy with the Center for American Progress.
We have a number of institutions that essentially today have an implied guarantee that they're too big to fail, and if they do fail, the government will come in to rescue them. In that situation, particularly when the federal government is propping up all of the lending devices by which these banks are making money, it seems difficult to imagine why the federal government, you know, might just sort of let these guys go back to a totally unregulated situation. When you're talking about these systemically important institutions, there have to be some strings attached here. There have to be sort of some mechanisms in play for Treasury to sort of regulate these guys.
Panel members also grilled Geithner about why money sent to auto companies had strings attached, such as management changes and terms, while money given to banks was more of a blank check. Again, Geithner.
Going forward, where institutions need exceptional levels of assistance, we will make sure that assistance comes with conditions that provide for the necessary degree of accountability, help ensure these firms emerge stronger rather than weaker. And that's an important principle. We're committed to do it. Now, what is necessary in each specific case is a judgment we're going to have to make. But I think that's a very important principle. It's at the core of our program.
Geithner said there had been some conditions on all the money distributed. And market analyst Mim points out that these terms had been negotiated last year.
Almost all of the bailouts, as they're being called, were actually negotiated. Those terms were negotiated by Secretary Paulson's Treasury. And so there weren't a lot of strings attached. There were, you know, sort of loosey-goosey.
Mim cites the recent takeover by AIG.
That was a case in which we got very bad terms for the taxpayer. And most importantly, we didn't have a lot of government controls over, you know, we made a huge investment in this company. We basically bought it out, but we didn't take any of the ownership mechanisms that one normally takes when they own 80% of a company, right? And so that's the real problem here is I think that we need to, going forward, make sure that we are, you know, ensuring that there's accountability.
Min says even without TARP funds, many of these institutions are receiving huge amounts of money from the government.
Many of the banks that and other financial institutions that have accepted TARP money are also accepting other forms of federal aid, both direct and indirect. These financial institutions are clearly, you know, sucking at the teat of the federal government in one way or another.
The committee has requested regular updates from Geithner on how TARP funds are being spent. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Congress is back from its spring break, and a top issue on the list of priorities is health care. Lawmakers say they want to craft legislation by June. That's just over 6 weeks from now. Backroom discussions among health care players are ongoing, but as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, as the debate becomes public, some health care reform advocates say they're left out of the discussion.
Senator Max Baucus, top Democrat on the Finance Committee, convened the first of three roundtable discussions on health care.
The point of this session is to ask questions, get information, try to find out what works, what doesn't work, and in what direction we should be proceeding.
This first public forum included mostly health care providers, doctors, nurses, and hospitals. Insurance companies were also present. These are the heavy lifters armed with a powerful lobby who have often shaped the health care debate in the past. This discussion has been ongoing for several months, both at the White House and at nationwide health forums hosted by the administration. behind-the-scenes discussions have also been active.
I think a lot of people in a lot of different forms trying to get their thoughts together, because now clearly the momentum is there to try to get something done this year.
Rich Umdenstock is president of the American Hospitals Association.
I think our nation's hospitals have been heard. I think we tell our story every day and how we care for patients and families and communities. And the members of Congress and the administration know that. They recognize that.
But not everyone interested in the healthcare debate is feeling included. Single-payer advocates, most of whom support an expansion of Medicare to cover all, say they have been locked out of the system. Laura Bonham is with Progressive Democrats of America.
We have been told or signaled to repeatedly that single-payer health care is off the table. And we personally, PDA, thinks it is outrageous that our elected officials are refusing to discuss this option.
Despite the absence of advocates for a single-payer, those with a seat at the table are pleased with the realm of the discussion. Ron Pollack is executive director of Families USA, which represents health consumer advocates. He's optimistic.
The various key interest groups, I think, understand that the status quo simply does not make any sense. So I think the stars are really lined up to get health reform done this year.
But consensus around the most difficult question is far from apparent, and that is how to provide all people with access to care. Without the discussion of single-payer, consumer advocates say it will likely be a mix of private and government-run health programs. Deborah Ness is president of the National Partnership for Women and Families.
How do we get to patient-centered care? That should really drive the way we think about redesigning the delivery system, and that should be the test that we use as to whether or not we succeeded. And I think a lot of times we have a system today that isn't really very patient-centered. It tends to be organized more around the providers of care than around the patients who receive the care.
But Rich Umdenstock with American Hospitals Association says anything government-run could be problematic.
If it's going to substitute for what's out there in private insurance and commercial pay, that's going to be a problem. It is of concern to us because of the history of public plans in this country. But we're willing to wait and see the details.
Single-payer advocates are continuing to rally at the grassroots level. They're hosting a week of house parties and town hall meetings, and they're also knocking on doors to spread the word about single-payer. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. A federal civil lawsuit began yesterday in New Orleans that charges that the Army Corps of Engineers contributed to post-Hurricane Katrina destruction by building and operating a poorly designed water channel. Six area residents contend that the navigation channel, known as Mr. Go, played a catastrophic role in the flooding of New Orleans when the levees broke in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in August 2005, and they're seeking hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages. But the suit's outcome could also mean that some 400,000 New Orleans residents may have a case in their claims as well. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Orleans.
U.S. District Court Judge Stanwood Duval ruled last month in favor of the plaintiffs in the case, Robinson versus United States, even though he'd ruled against previous efforts to hold the Corps of Engineers accountable. The Corps has immunity from prosecution for failure of its flood control projects, like levees. But the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet Channel, known as Mr. Go, was a navigation channel, not a flood control project. The 76-mile channel opened in 1963 to provide a shortcut for ocean-going vessels between the Gulf of Mexico and New Orleans so they wouldn't have to snake up the Mississippi River.
There were calls for the closure of Mr. Go as it opened.
Pam Dashiel is co-director of a community project in the Holy Cross neighborhood of the Lower Ninth Ward. She said opposition to Mr. Goh was one reason her group was founded decades ago. Over the years, the channel widened from around 500 feet to 1,500 feet. Dashiell says it's always been a huge issue.
Over many years, the people in this area fought to close Mr. Goh because it eroded, because it presented a danger to the community because of its erosion. It goes straight to the Gulf, and the fear was that that water would come up the Mr. Goh and inundate the communities around New Orleans, and that's exactly what happened. It's been an unmitigated disaster.
To construct Mr. Goh, the Corps had to destroy wetlands, which had reduced the storm surge from hurricanes. It also allowed huge amounts of water to rush in when Katrina struck the region, overtopping the levees and causing several breaches. Hardest hit were the city's Lower Ninth Ward, East New Orleans, and neighboring St. Bernard Parish, which was virtually 100% flooded after Katrina. Attorney Joseph M. Bruno is representing the six plaintiffs.
When, you know, you ask the Corps, were you at all interested in the fact that you were destroying the environment? I mean, I took the depositions myself. And startlingly, the answer to my question was, the destruction of the marsh was irrelevant to us because our mandate was to keep the channel open for navigation.
A spokesperson for the U.S. Department of Justice, which is representing the Corps of Engineers, said he could not comment due to the pending litigation. Mr. Goh was deauthorized by the Corps of Engineers last June, and in late March, a ceremonial rock was placed to begin the closure. Steve Gonzalez is a lifelong resident of St. Bernard Parish. He helped his disabled wife escape through the roof as the Katrina floodwaters rose to the top of their home. But he said her heart never recovered, and she died 6 months later.
When my wife died, I don't know why I did it at the time, but I just wanted confirmation of why she died. And I asked the doctor, would he put it on the death certificate, Katrina-related death, and he did.
Gonzalez is one of 400,000 people who have signed onto a class action lawsuit against Mr. Goh, which will proceed if and when the Robinson case is settled in favor of the plaintiffs. Gonzalez has put in a claim for $500,000.
I lost three cars, a house, I lost all my pets, and then I lost my wife. I think that kind of classifies as a maximum amount. Because we were married 42 years, it's not easy to go without her. So I just get by the best way I can, day to day.
The case goes to trial before Judge Duval on April 20th. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Orleans.
Most of us have an old cell phone or computer that doesn't work anymore and can't really be fixed. Once these things get thrown out, where do they wind up? Well, recent studies indicate that broken gadgets that arrive in developing countries are disguised as secondhand electronic goods, but are in fact electronic waste, which is an open violation of international treaties that ban the transboundary movements of hazardous wastes. Sam Alokoya reports from Lagos, where defunct items become toxic electronic junk that threatens human health.
Television sets, refrigerators, mobile phones, computers, and much more. An open dump site like this one in Lagos City's densely populated suburb, Olusosun, receives several truckloads of e-waste every day. According to the Basel Action Network, a Seattle-based environmental group that studies global toxic trade, some 400,000 second-hand computers are imported every month to Nigeria. About three-quarters of these are unusable and reach the Olusosun dump yard. The dysfunctional electrical goods are disposed of by burning, and the air is full of toxic fumes. I visited Olusosun with Leslie Adogame, an environmentalist, who has been campaigning against e-waste. He says this disposal method constitutes serious dangers.
I tell you that on a daily basis, as you pass by this road, you see some of this waste being burned. There's open burning, and open burning of some of these components produce a lot of particulate matters. All these are burned here. You can see the closeness to the highway, and the closer you can see the neighboring community all around here. And if you take a what are called proximate sampling analysis of that particulate smoke coming out there, then you see a lot of furans and dioxins coming out from it.
Furans and dioxins are toxic and carcinogenic. Ola Oresanya is the head of LOMA, the government agency responsible for waste disposal in Lagos. He says there is no better way to discard the e-waste since the city lacks recycling facilities.
Well, honestly, we're not treating e-waste right now, and it's a major problem, it's a major challenge. The level we are is aware, the level of awareness. We're aware of the dangers of this e-waste. And very few people are aware, actually, of the dangers of this e-waste. We have a pile-up of them, and we've been educating people who have been burning the e-waste, burning the PCBs, releasing furans, dioxins into the air. We've been educating them, and I would believe they will change.
But the environmentalists believe combating e-waste should go beyond education. The waste are imported to Nigeria duty-free, so shipping unusable waste in the name of second-hand goods should stop first. The international environmental activist group Greenpeace recently carried out an investigation on how e-waste from the United Kingdom make its way to Africa.
My name's Stan, and I've recently been involved in an investigation into illegal exports of waste electronic equipment from the UK to Africa. The regulations covering waste electronic equipment in the UK mean that everything has to be certified as sort of working before it's exported.
Using a tracking device, Greenpeace found that a broken television set in a UK home avoided testing and recycling regulations of the EU. The television set was taken to the docks for export to Nigeria almost as soon as it arrived at a recycling plant in London.
Pretty much the next day, that TV, with no testing, nothing, was then loaded into a container, which we documented, and then that container travelled to Tilbury Docks, and it was then waiting to be loaded onto a ship. The ship called the Grand America does a regular route from London to West Africa, and it also called in at Antwerp and various West African ports, where we also got a signal back from it, and then into Lagos.
Following the local and international outcry, the Nigerian government says it intends to take measures to curb the imports, but no action has yet been taken. Meanwhile, the 100 acres big Olusosun dumpyard grows larger day by day. Sam Olukoya, Free Speech Radio News, Lagos.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.